It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Freezer Friday. That's Food Friday, talking about freezer meals, recipes that are just as good, if not better, once you've made, frozen, and then reheated them. First, the pandemic left many of us with more time to explore our hobbies or try new ones. Hobbies can be a good way to pass the time and discover our passions. Sometimes, though, they can feel less like leisure and more like work. Some are more relaxing than others, but just because a hobby is productive doesn't mean it's better or worse than any others. Our next guest has written about the history of hobbies, what they say about ourselves and our economy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your hobbies? Do you find them relaxing? Are they productive? A little bit of both? How important are they in your life? Have you ever tried to turn a hobby into a source of income? Have you ever felt guilty for not doing enough of your hobby? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stephen Gelber is a historian and professor emeritus at Santa Clara University. He's author of the book Hobbies, Leisure, and the Culture of Work in America. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Historically, when did we first see what we now think of as hobbies really come into their own as part of our mass culture?
As part of the mass culture, in the Victorian period, hobbies become a way for people who are increasingly having leisure time to fill it. Women have more than men, because men are now leaving the home to go to work, and men eventually join as they get more time off after work and on weekends. We're talking here primarily about middle-class people.
You've written specifically about a hobby boom during the Great Depression here in the United States. Can you talk about why hobbies got big in this tough time?
Yes. My basic position on hobbies, or at least on many hobbies, not on all, is that they replicate work. In other words, what people do in their hobbies requires some of the same skills and many of the same values that they use when they're on the job. If they don't have a job, then they look for something to do in their leisure time that will replicate what they normally would have done, or at least give them the sense of satisfaction that they normally would have gotten from work.
And I want to talk about that idea you just introduced there, the idea that a hobby at home that we might think of as it's this thing that I do when I'm not working. You say that over time it almost was like taking our work attitude, our work regimentation in some ways, and figuring out a way to use it at home. Can you talk about that a little more?
Sure. Until the Industrial Revolution, people's leisure time was more or less interspersed with their work time. If you worked in handicrafts at home, or if you were a farmer, or if you ran a small shop, you could always stop working. I mean, you could stop working and go to lunch. You could stop working and go fishing. Sometimes you had to stop working because it was Wisconsin and there was too much snow. You had to milk the cows, but otherwise it may not be that much to do. In other words, leisure time was part of the daily cycle of things. But once people began to work away from home, in factories, in offices, their leisure time became a time when they could not work even if they wanted to. And so they looked for things to do, and traditionally or historically, leisure time was always seen as a dangerous time because you could drink, you could gamble, you could do things that were not approved of by the traditional Protestant work ethic society, and that was particularly true in the United States.
And there are other kinds of leisure time that I think we tend to look down on, even if they're not a vice, like you mentioned, the drinking and gambling, just sheer slacking, doing nothing. Maybe now we might include watching TV or something like that in that category. How have we built these barriers between, I guess, okay uses of our leisure time, a hobby, versus just slacking?
The hobbies came to be seen by powers that be, which by which we mean mostly educators, but not exclusively parents, a form of educators, as a way to use leisure time usefully or productively, as you said in your introduction. If you're doing something useful or productive, then you're not doing something that's a vice or destructive. And so hobbies, particularly in the 30s, came to be promoted as a way to prevent people who were not working, either voluntarily or involuntarily, from becoming, dangerous. People who are drinking, people who are engaging in public vices, people who are just lying about are, from a social, cultural point of view, they're dangerous people. They're not productive people. And so hobbies fill that void. They require you, or at least the hobbies I talk about in my book, require you to do many of the same things that you would do at work. Not literally, obviously, they're leisure, but you need to think about them. You need to plan for them. You do them and you get some sort of a product. It's a product that you can show off. This is the same mental process. This is the same, if you will, psychological or sociological process that you go through in your work. And so then your work and your leisure time reinforce each other rather than create a kind of cognitive dissonance or a kind of conflict between what you do at work and what you do in leisure.
Do you think that's bad, that we have this work mentality into our hobby, our leisure life?
Not at all. No. I'm not passing any kind of a value judgment here. I got interested in this aspect of hobbies because I started thinking about, well, why do I do the things that I do and how do they work? And I think all human beings, probably in almost all societies, try to make their lives congruent. That is to say, they don't want to do things that in one sphere of their life that conflict in some fundamental way with the things they do in another sphere of their life. And so they, either consciously, but probably mostly subconsciously, look to create a kind of, as they say, a kind of congruence or a kind of continuity between work and leisure.
Talking to Stephen Gelber, historian and professor emeritus at Santa Clara University, author of the book Hobbies, Leisure, and the Culture of Work in America. You can join in to tell us about your hobby, what led you to pick it up, what it means to you, why you like doing it more than something else or nothing else in your off time. Call 800-642-1234. If you picked up a new hobby or rediscovered an old one during the pandemic, let us know. 800-642-1234. Stephen, your book came out before this current pandemic, but I think hobbies have changed for people. We've had more time, maybe more desire to do these things. And for a lot of people, the line between home and work disappeared because a lot of them were working at home. What are your thoughts on what that might have meant for hobbies?
I have given that a fair amount of thought, not as a scholar since I am retired, but I think what's happening is that people are looking for ways to remain productive in their own eyes. In other words, what you're doing when you take up whatever it is you're taking up in most of them seem to be craft hobbies, baking bread or doing scrapbooks or whatever it is that you are saying, look, I'm working sometimes and I'm doing hobbies sometimes, but I am doing them in a way, I'm doing each of those in a way that reinforces the other and makes me feel maybe less guilty about being home and not going into the office. But of course, that's sheer conjecture on my part. I don't have any hard data to back that up.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Newton. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to share my new hobby that I've discovered since the pandemic started. And I'm sure it's a hobby a lot of people do, but I never realized how fulfilling it could be. And that's paint by number. I paint by number every day. I can't wait till I get home. I think about my painting when I'm at work. I can't wait to finish it. I take a picture after each color, and then I post it on the internet and show everybody how it came together. And then I store them in a box and never put them anywhere. It's just the doing them that's fun, and I never hang them up or do much with them, but I just love it.
It's fun, and Rebecca, I wonder, it sounds like the kind of thing, like I started doing jigsaw puzzles really for the first time ever, and it's like your brain is focused on this thing, and I don't know, it blocks out the other stuff. Is that just me, or do you feel that too?
Very much so, and it took my mind off of the stress of the pandemic and the worry. It helped me focus. It gives me a lot of focus. And it's just, I don't know, my job is very stressful. I work in healthcare. I treat COVID patients. So when I come home, I want something that takes my mind off that and just keeps me busy so I don't have time to think or worry. And I just love it. And I don't know. I'm going to keep doing it.
I love it. Thanks for sharing that story, Rebecca. Thanks for the work you're doing. I'm glad you found a great way to do something in your off time. What do you think, Stephen?
The kinds of hobbies that you were speaking of and that the caller spoke of are, I think, a different category from what I'm talking about. I would call those sort of meditative. In other words, if you're doing something where the process is predefined and you're just sort of engaging in it, which is certainly a jigsaw puzzle, unless, of course, you're designing and building your own jigsaw puzzle.
I am not.
But the caller said something very interesting, which is, I think, a crucial component of a hobby, and that is she said she was, while she was at work, she was thinking about it. And the thing that one of the components of a hobby that make them hobbies is they take up a lot of mental space. I joke in my book, but it's partially a joke, is hobbies are like sex. You think, you spend much more time thinking about it than you do doing it. But it occupies your mind, and it, in that sense, it becomes more important than the actual doing of the hobby.
Interesting. Thanks again for that call. We're talking to historian Stephen Gelber about hobbies and why we do them. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your hobbies, what they mean in your life, if you've picked up new ones, if you've changed your approach to hobbies, maybe during the pandemic. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with historian Stephen Gelber. He's with us today talking about hobbies and how we strike a balance between leisure and productivity. And you could join in with your hobby at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you're into, what you've gotten into lately, what it means in your life, in your leisure time. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go back to your calls now. John is with us in Minocqua. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your hobby, John?
Well, my hobby throughout my entire life has been home remodeling. And I've worked in the corporate world my entire life and decided to take my hobby and make it my work. So I have partially retired and now have a handyman business. So I've gotten out of the corporate world and just decided to start my own business and turn my hobby into my work.
Well, John, a question I have for anybody, I think, who takes a hobby and turns it into a job. Is it less fun when it's, you know you're dependent on the money where you're getting paid for it and having to meet somebody else's needs?
So far it has not been.
Good.
I just enjoy doing it. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy helping people out. Kind of our focus of our business is helping seniors stay in their homes a little bit longer through basic remodeling to keep them safe. So that's it's rewarding in itself.
Oh, I love it. It's very purposeful. John, thanks for sharing that. Stephen, the idea, I think, has come up for a lot of people of, can my hobby be something I make money at? John's found a happy answer that I think, I don't know if everybody does.
That is one of the chronic questions among hobbyists. Can I turn my hobby into a job? And, of course, people like the caller have done that, and they're very happy doing that. But usually the answer has been, no, they can't, because that what makes a hobby leisure rather than work is that you are the complete a boss. You don't depend on it. You work when you do. That is to say, you work at your hobby when you do and when you want to, and you don't when you don't want to. If you turn it into your job, then you have to meet your costs. You have to make a profit. You have to do a kind of accounting, and it ceases to be the same thing. You still may enjoy it, of course. Mm-hmm. But your caller, of course, noted he was in semi-retirement, so he's only semi-working at a semi-hobby. So he created a balance by doing half of each.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. Keep up the good work at 800-642-1234. Eric joins us next in Green Bay. Eric, hello.
Hi.
Oh, what did you want to tell us about, Eric?
I crochet, have been for like 25 years.
Cool.
And
what do you like about it?
It's like Zen. It's repetitive. And so it's relaxing. And I can do it while I'm like watching TV or listening to NPR, because I don't have to focus on it if I don't have to watch what I'm doing, like driving, for instance. I can crochet. So it's just been it's relaxing for me.
And Eric, can I ask, what do you do with the final products?
So I tend to give them away. I do a lot of dishcloths and washcloths because they're easy to do while I'm just sitting around. But I have a couple bins underneath my bed just full of dishcloths and washcloths. But blankets and scarves and socks. I've done socks.
Excellent. Eric, I strongly approve of any hobby you can do while you listen to public radio. Stephen, your thoughts? It's a Zen thing. There is a final product. He shares it with people around him.
Yes. One element of that, of course, is what, like jigsaw puzzles we spoke about earlier, is it's routine, and you can pay attention to it, but you don't have to totally focus on it. You can be focused on something else. But there is a product, and the product has value. You can sell it at a Christmas craft fair, or you can give it to people for their birthday, or you can use it in your house, and people will come and say, oh, that's wonderful. You should make those and sell them. You know, and there's a kind of satisfaction that comes from that, where people confirm that you are doing something productive. Historically, if I may add just a note here,
sure.
That is one of the major differences between the kinds of hobbies that men and women did. Men tend to do things that have a more obvious market value, whereas women tended to do things that had more of an aesthetic value, that they were considered beautiful, or they were, you know, not merely that they were feminine objects. Obviously, crochet was more traditionally a female hobby, but the fact that the man who called in was, you know, he made these products and then he was giving them away, that kind of crosses the gender line a little bit. But it's a complicated one. And, of course, as women have become more and more engaged in the work-for-hire sphere, then that whole distinction has blurred. And I assume that there is a real blurring in hobby divisions, but I'm actually, you have to speak to a sociologist about that.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Time for at least one more caller. Russ is on the line in Belleville. Russ, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Well, I got into making birdhouses, but I use unique material. I use rigid styrofoam that typically is used in the building trade.
Okay, and you make birdhouses. Now, I assume you can only have so many birdhouses in your yard. Is this something you share with other people, maybe in your neighborhood?
Well, I share online with these birdhouses are for purple martins, which is a species that's totally dependent on humans. So I share it with a website of other purple martin landlords or wannabe landlords. So I'm just spreading the knowledge, and I came up with this technique where I make single units now that I use a lamination technique. I don't think anyone's ever done it before, and just cool to invent something and make it and then see how it ends up.
I love it, Russ. Good luck luring purple martins to your latest houses. Thanks for sharing that story with us. Stephen, there's a pride there in his invention he mentioned.
Absolutely, and a creativity. He thinks he has come up with a new technique for making birdhouses. And this is precisely the sort of thing that I was talking about. He, in his leisure time, he does a hobby with a product, and it's not merely a product, it's a product that he thought of, and he thinks of new ways of doing it, and it's a form of creativity, absolutely.
Thanks for that call, Russ. In our last few moments, Stephen, if I may ask a personal question, do you have a favorite hobby?
I do. I design and build things out of wood, furniture, boxes, artworks. I've been a woodworker for most of my life. I started off because I needed to make things for the house I couldn't afford and continued because I just enjoy doing woodwork.
I love it. We'll leave it there. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
That's Stephen Gelber, historian and professor emeritus at Santa Clara University. He's author of the book Hobbies, Leisure, and the Culture of Work in America. Thanks for all of your calls about your hobbies. You can still email ideas@WPR.org if you have a hobby story to share with us. Coming up after the news, what's your favorite thing to cook and then freeze to save for later? We're talking about great freezer meals on this week's edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, early voting is underway in the primary for Milwaukee's mayoral race. We'll talk about how the candidates stack up with one another and where they fall on a couple key issues for the city. Now, here's a kitchen situation you might have experienced. It's the end of the day or end of the week, and you haven't planned anything special for dinner. You don't want to turn to delivery or carry out. You're at a loss. But wait, the freezer. The past version of you did the current version of you a big favor and prepared a couple freezer meals. You pop one in the microwave for a few minutes or the stove for a while, and boom, it's dinner. On this edition of Food Friday, our guest has lots of advice for great food for the freezer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a go-to meal that you like to make and freeze for your own future or maybe to give to somebody who needs that little something? What things do you like to make and then freeze? Are you new to the concept? Do you have questions about what to make and how to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aaron Clark is creator of WellPlated.com and author of The Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
You are a big fan of cooking with freezing in mind. Why is that a big part of your cooking arsenal?
You know, as much as I love to cook, let's be honest, sometimes it can kind of be a pain or you just don't have time. And the thing about dinner is that it happens every single night. And so whenever I am cooking, it is just as easy to make a little bit more. And then I love stashing the leftovers away in the freezer for busy nights to come.
Now, how many meals do you reckon you have in the freezer at any given time?
Well, I would say I probably have about 2 to 3 different meals. It's just my husband and I, but we both work from home. So that kind of keeps us going for both lunch and dinner. And then I also love to keep a handful of staple freezer ingredients on hand for if I need to whip up a quick meal. So for example, I'll always have a bag of stir-fry vegetables in my freezer so that if I need to whip up a quick stir-fry, I don't have to deal with chopping a bunch of vegetables. I can just reach in and grab one of those, that kind of thing.
How about organizing in the freezer? Mine can be kind of, you know, a difficult place to navigate sometimes. Any advice on keeping track and keeping things clear in there?
Definitely. So, I mean, yes, a freezer can be kind of an interactive game of Tetris, choose your own adventure. Two big tips that I have are to think about grouping things into sections. So I know for my own freezer, we have a drawer style one. So anything that is meat related, I always put to the left of the freezer so that, you know, if I'm looking for some meat to thaw for dinner, I don't need to upend the whole freezer. I just know, hey, like, did I throw those chicken thighs in there or not? I know there's just one place in the freezer I have to look. And if they're not there, I don't have them. And then I usually will say, oh, hey, I forgot I had that ground hamburger. Surprise. Here we go. And then, you know, so just however that kind of works for you. My other big tip is to label things. It's like one of those things that you're just tired, you're cleaning up dinner, you're like, no, I don't want to do this. It does not need to be fancy. Just, you know, if you have something wrapped in foil, just get out a Sharpie, write roughly like what it is and the date. I can't even tell you how many times I've reached into my freezer for something. I think like, oh, well, this is only like 3 weeks old, it'll be fine. And then it's like, just kidding. I'm pretty sure that this is from winter of, you know, 2020 or whenever, however the heck long it's been back there. So our memories are not very good for that. So just take that minute, write it on, you know, I just wrap things usually in aluminum foil, pop them in a zip top bag, and then I'll write what it is on the foil so then I can reuse the zip top bag afterwards.
That saves me a lot of freezer archaeology once I finally learned the hard way to label stuff.
Yes.
Now, how about you also make the case for thinking in portions, not just putting in a huge amount of food X, but the way you're actually going to serve it, freezing it that way.
Exactly. So you just have to think about what makes sense for your family. So for my family, you know, it's my husband and I, so if I'm making a big pot of beef stew and say we want to have half of it for meals the next couple days, and then I want to save the half it for meals to come, rather than freezing, you know, don't freeze. Or if you're instead of making, so you really want to get into the freezer and you want to make two pots of soup instead of one, you know, if you are a smaller household, do not freeze all of your soup in one batch, because it's going to take forever to thaw. And then you're going to be in a situation where you have leftovers and you're wanting to put it back into the freezer. And I do not recommend refreezing things. So if you could just kind of take that step ahead. As a bonus, it's much easier to find space for smaller containers than it is for larger containers. So you'll be doing yourself a favor and making it easier to organize your freezer too.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Aaron Clark, creator of WellPlated.com, author of the WellPlated Cookbook. We're talking about great meals to make with freezing in mind. You make a double batch, say, eat some now, put some in the freezer for the future. Do you cook this way? What are some of your favorite things? Maybe some advice you have? Or do you have a question about how to make and freeze different kinds of foods? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aaron, you've shared a few recipes with us. One, we've got a full recipe up. We've got a couple links also at WPR.org/Food Friday. Here's one I'm excited about: frozen breakfast sandwiches that we make and then freeze. I wouldn't have even thought of doing this. Talk about the basics that go into making your frozen breakfast sandwiches.
Definitely. So the inspiration for these were a certain drive-through with Golden Arches, which is still a guilty pleasure breakfast of mine, but they have these delicious English muffin breakfast sandwiches. And I kind of wanted to come up with a way to make those myself from scratch. And then I ended up combining that with, you know, that style of sandwich is really popular in the frozen food section at the grocery store. And I thought, okay, well, why would I stop for fast food, or why would I buy something with a lot of processed ingredients from the freezer section when I can just make it myself? It's a lot healthier and a lot less expensive. So this recipe comes from my cookbook, the Well-Plated Cookbook. And the great thing about it is that it is so super versatile. So you bake actually eggs in a 9x13-inch pan. They come out in a sheet, and then you can cut them, either you can stamp them out into rounds or just use a knife to cut them into squares. You assemble them with, you know, cheese, bacon, whatever you want, right on the English muffin. You can wrap it whole and pop it into the freezer. Then on a busy morning to come, rather than, you know, reaching for a donut or grabbing fast food on the way to work, just knowing that you have that in the freezer, you can pull it right out and reheat it directly from frozen. It is so delicious. And especially this time of year, just having a fresh, warm breakfast can really set your day off on the right note. And it's a really healthy way to begin your day, too.
Now, here's a sign of how dumb I am, Aaron. I read this recipe and was like, are cooked eggs going to freeze okay? Then a few minutes later, I thought, the number one thing I make with freezing in mind is quiche, which is eggs.
Yes.
They come out fine.
Yes.
So the eggs you bake and put on these sandwiches, they freeze, they come out, and they're good and eggy?
They are great. I mean, no one will know that you have, that this was previously frozen. It's really pretty fantastic. I recommend microwaving them on a paper. The biggest issue isn't actually the eggs. It's keeping the English muffins from getting soggy. So I recommend microwaving it on wrapped in a paper towel, and that paper towel will absorb the moisture and keep it off your bread. But eggs, actually, cooked eggs freeze like a dream. You can even freeze raw eggs, as long as you can either scramble them first, and for example, pour them in a mini muffin tin and then just like freeze them, you know, in portions that way if you happen to have a lot of eggs. The only two things you can't freeze, you cannot freeze the egg in the shell, and don't freeze hard-boiled eggs. They taste terrible. I tried, it does not go well, but scrambled eggs are fantastic frozen. And quiche. Quiche is another one of my absolute freezer favorites.
So we're going to call her now at 800-642-1234. Philip is with us in Milwaukee. Philip, hi.
Yes, I would like to know how long one can keep shrimp and fish in the freezer.
Now, Philip, are you talking like stuff you bought frozen or whatever, you haven't cooked it yet? Or are you talking about you cooked a meal with shrimp or fish in it, now you're freezing it?
No, just frozen.
Okay. Philip, thanks for the call. I don't know if you have the that kind of information in front of you, Aaron. We're mostly talking about the cooked meals today, but any thoughts for Philip?
Definitely. So my general rule of thumb is just when in doubt, I say about 3 months. You know, if the fish is, if you have wrapped it really tightly and, you know, you froze it right when the thing with raw ingredients is you want to freeze them when they are at their peak of freshness. The idea of the freezer is to save something at its peak of freshness to enjoy at a later time or help you with meal planning. What you don't want to do is take a fish that's been sitting in your refrigerator for like 4 days. Oops, I didn't get around to cooking it, and then throw it in the freezer because it's not going to be any better when it comes out. The freezer is not like, does not magically transform your food. But if you wrap it really air, once the fish is in your freezer, assuming you froze it fresh, your biggest enemy at that point really is just frost building up on it more than it is, you know, like if you can freeze bacteria in the sense that if something is cooked and you let it sit out and you throw it in the freezer won't kill the bacteria. But if you keep it off there to begin with, it's not going to magically appear in the freezer. So the idea is just to keep the frost off of it. And I generally find that 3 months works for just about anything, including fish. Fish, because it's a little more sensitive, you might want to look to about a month. But I would say generally meat, stews, casseroles, 3 months is good with that. And then things like pie crust, I've gone up to 6 months. I once found a homemade pie crust that was a year old, I'm going to say it, and homemade pie crust is a lot of work, so I just went ahead and baked it and didn't say anything, and it was fine.
Great.
So it's really just kind of looking for the freezer burn, and then once you thaw, like, give it a sniff, make sure it still smells nice and fresh.
Philip, thanks for the call. We're talking to Aaron Clark, creator of the wellplated.com website, author of the book Well Plated Cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. It's Food Friday. Aaron's with us to talk about some of her favorite recipes to freeze and then reheat later. For a lot of convenience, you could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a meal freezing question for our guest or a favorite go-to that you like to maybe cook extra and freeze some for later. Call in at 800-642-1234. Find some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Aaron Clark, food blogger, cookbook author. We're talking about freezer meals. She's got a couple recipes for things to freeze, store, and reheat shared with us over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Author of the cookbook, The Well-Plated Cookbook. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Keith is with us in Green Bay. Keith, hi.
Hello. My summer hobby is gardening. So I tend to put a lot of my garden produce in the freezer. But rather than making complete meals, I will freeze my garden produce in square Tupperware containers in more like serving size portions. Once it's frozen, then I can throw it in my air sucker bag and have component parts in my freezers stacked up in bricks.
Ooh, what kind of components are your favorites to work with, Keith?
Oh, things like frozen corn and frozen beans that I've grown myself. I have my own tomato sauces. A lot of it's in jars, but I like to have some of it frozen. Things of that sort. And if it's in a square brick, it takes up less room in the freezer than if it's in sour cream containers. Those little round things, you know, they do take up space. But if you do them square, they take up less space.
I love it.
And I've tried, since I'm alone now, I used to do pans of lasagna. But if you've got like a dozen bricks of lasagna in the freezer, it gets a little boring. This way I can make a small amount of something, or I can have the components ready to go. You know, I can take a brick of green beans and a brick of corn and frozen tomato sauce and some chicken stock and, or, you know, whatever. And I can make my winter minestrone out of component parts. And it tastes fresher to me than having it all made up already.
That sounds great, Keith. I love that idea. And Aaron, you mentioned the idea of freezing is to, you know, get stuff when it's fresh and freeze it. It's right out of his garden there and then ready to rock whenever he wants it.
I want to come raid your freezer, Keith. That sounds like the freezer of my dreams right there.
Yeah. And Keith mentioned lasagna. I think along with quiche, that's another classic. Make a goodly amount of it and then freeze some of it. Do you have a favorite lasagna bit of advice, Aaron, for freezing?
A great point that Keith actually made was I had some, when I was single, I made myself an entire lasagna, and I don't think I could eat lasagna for about a year after I finished it. So either, you know, just being realistic about how much you're going to eat. And, you know, if you do make a whole lasagna and you know that you're not going to get to all 12 bricks of it that are in your freezer, it's also okay to share with people to give it away. A nice thing about lasagna is that it is really easy to slice and portion, and you can actually bake it directly from frozen, provided that you use a freezer safe dish. And then I like to put the lasagna in the oven while it is preheating so that it can, you know, start to thaw as the oven comes to temperature. And casseroles work really nicely that way too.
Keith, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Dawn in Dodgeville. Dawn, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I love using the freezer, particularly for portion control, because it's just my husband and I. And so one of our favorite things to make is a huge pot of chili. And chili is one of those foods that taste better the second time around than when you originally make it. And we also love to have dessert. So I bake a lot of desserts, and I cut them up into individual portion sizes, label them, put them in the freezer.
Oh.
Every night when we finish our dinner, then I say, okay, what would you like for dessert tonight? And my husband makes a choice. And then I immediately take it out and just set it out. And it's about an hour and a half or 2 hours later that we actually have our dessert with a cup of coffee. And by then, it's defrosted, and it's wonderful.
And you don't have the whole pan sitting there, so you don't think, I'll just have one more piece.
Oh, exactly. It makes it just, and we are also RVers, and we have a motorhome.
Oh.
And so this is just a very easy way to say, okay, what desserts should we take with us? And breakfast casseroles. I make 9 by 13 pans of breakfast casseroles, cut them up into 8 or 12 pieces, freeze them, and okay, what would you like to have for breakfast on this camping trip?
Fantastic. Dawn, you gave us a lot to work with. Dawn's a big freezer fan. I want to key in on one word she said there, Aaron, because the word was chili, and you have shared, we've got a link at wpr.org/foodfriday to your, it was a white chicken chili. Can you tell us about that?
One of my chili is one of my favorite foods to freeze as well. To Don's point, it really does. Maybe there is an exception to things will get better in the freezer. I think chili might be the one exception to that rule. And something that I love about it is that no two chilies are alike, and there's a chili for every mood and season. So as much as I love like a hearty tomato-based chili, the recipe that I have shared with WPR is a white chicken chili. It is a little bit lighter, very freezer friendly, and you can make it in the stovetop or the crock pot. I think that chili should be very thick. As my husband would say, if I can't stand my spoon up in it, then it's not really chili. The trick that I use for this one is it has white beans in it, and you puree it just a little bit, and the beans help to make it really thick and rich.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Again, you can find a link at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is Food Friday with a focus on freezer meals. Aaron Clark is with us, author of the well-plated cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. Back to your calls now. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi. Several things. My husband and I are vegetarians, so we don't deal with meat and fish. And I wanted to... I would appreciate it that you raised the question of freezing raw eggs, because we have backyard chickens, and when we have a super abundance of eggs, we just freeze them, and they keep for years. And we've used them when we've had a paucity of eggs. We have a huge garden. We do lots of lasagna and freezing of vegetables. But the main thing that I wanted to raise is that we have several chest freezers that are not frost-free. And if you are using the freezing compartment of your refrigerator in your kitchen, it's almost certainly going to be a frost-free refrigerator, which means it goes through a freezer. It goes through freezing and then thawing cycles to get rid of the frost. And foods will not keep as well in a freezer like that. So what we do is we either use freezer containers that are squared shape blocks that are blocks, or we use vacuum sealing. And foods in our chest freezers that do not, they just stay cold all the time. They don't go through that thawing cycle. Foods keep for years. We've dug out, 4 or 5 year old. What we do is we defrost the freezer once or twice a year. And then we can reorganize it and discover things that have gotten lost.
Stella. We don't have too much time left, but thanks for sharing that and a little freezer technology there too. Aaron, you're big on freezing. Have you gone into having that second freezer, whether a chest freezer or otherwise?
We haven't, and then I can't even tell you how many times I am trying to, again, Tetris my freezer at home and wishing that I had one. So I think that is maybe going to be on my birthday list this year, as exciting of a birthday present as that would be.
Thanks again for that call. Aaron, what kind of freezer projects, cooking projects do you have in mind for this weekend, maybe with the freezer in mind?
With this chilly weather, I have been so in the mood for comfort food, and I have not had chicken pot pie for a while. That is another really freezer-friendly recipe. So I think I'm going to make a double batch of that, one for us to enjoy for dinner, and then I'm going to pop the other in my freezer for a snowy day to come.
And then you make your own crusts on those, did you mention earlier?
I do. I mean, I will say there is no shame in a store-bought pie crust. We are only human. You don't have to be a hero all the time. If someone does want a pie crust recipe, I have a pretty foolproof one on my website, wellplated.com.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been great being here. Thank you.
Been talking to Aaron Clark, creator of wellplated.com and author of the Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. She joined us for this week's edition of Food Friday. We've been talking about recipes and strategies for freezing and reheating great meals. We've got recipes from Aaron for you. You can find the full recipe for Aaron's freezer breakfast sandwiches. This one, I think I got to try sometime. Find the full recipe there. And then there's links to that white chicken chili we talked about. Oh, and we had so many calls, we didn't get to a third recipe. I love squash. Crockpot butternut squash soup. This one's going to freeze up real good as well. You can find them all on our website at WPR.org/Central Time. And hey, still time for you to share your freezer food favorites with as much alliteration as you want. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you like to cook and keep in your freezer and when you like to use it. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some people at elder care facilities can face the risk of eviction. Find out why and what they and their families can do about it. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Want to take a minute to say a sad but fond farewell to longtime Ideas Network producer Bill Martins. Bill worked, I worked with him on the Joy Cardine show back in the day for a bunch of years. He came over to Central Time. That's where he's been working for the last bunch of years. He's moving on to a new media adventure now. First, Bill, good luck to you in the new job. We've said it off the air. I'm saying it on the air too. And if you're listening, you may have heard Bill's voice on the air. He's been on this show from time to time. You may have heard him during member drives. You might have heard his voice. I promise you, you've heard the fruits of his labor. He's found so many of the guests we've talked to over the many years he's been here, many of the great ideas. He's just contributed so much to the morning and afternoon sound here on the Ideas Network. Bill Martins, good luck. Again, thanks for all the great work here on the Ideas Network. We're really going to miss you.